From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our relationships with it. I'm Chris Cherniak.
And I'm Claire Wiley. Now, it's estimated that over the next 30 years, somewhere around 10% of Americans could be moving as a result of climate change.
That's right. Where will this migration occur? And how do we prepare as a nation? In his new book, On the Move, The Overheating Earth and the Uprooting of America, investigative journalist Abram Lustgarten reports the scientific and policy causes and implications for climate-driven migration in the U.S. and forecasts specifically how many Americans may move as a result of climate change, where they will go, and when. All that in the first part of the show.
Then in the second part of the show, we're going to be speaking with Alexa Friedman about the presence of various types of pesticides showing up on fruits and vegetables.
That's right. Friedman will talk us through a recent report issued by the Environmental Working Group that highlights those fruits and vegetables with high types and levels of pesticides, like non-organic strawberries, spinach, peaches, and blueberries, while others, like cabbage, mushrooms, and melons, are relatively clean.
So why do some fruits and vegetables contain literally dozens of types of pesticides, while others not so much? And what can we do to reduce exposure to these chemicals? Environmental... Don't do that to me again. Alexa Friedman will help explain. Also joining is Dita Seed with the Center for Biological Diversity to talk about an effect to protect a threatened migratory bird. So that's all coming up. We've got a really hefty show today.
That's right. Environmental awareness and education. That's what This Green Earth is all about. Stay with us.
And we're back. This is This Green Earth. I'm Claire Wiley.
And I'm Chris Cherniak, and joining us in the first part of the show is Abram Lustgarten. He's the author of the new book, On the Move, The Overheating Earth and the Uprooting of America. Abram, thank you so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Oh, yes, we can hear you. Great.
Thanks for having me. Happy
thank
to be
you.
Here.
Hey, I'll make sure I got this right. Your book, On the Move. Is it released today? Is it available today?
Today is the day.
Oh, my goodness.
It is officially on sale.
Oh, well.
We're very timely
actually,
in this, Chris.
Then we're honored for you to take the time to chat with us about on a very busy and joyous day. So thank you to talk about something that maybe at times is not so joyous. But that's what we cover here on This Green Earth.
We try to keep it a little bit on the uplifting side of things. Well, so we'll get into the nitty gritty and then we'll talk about maybe some of the good parts of it.
Well, there is...
Yeah, we all get bogged down if we don't do that, right?
Exactly. Well, let's dig into your book, On the Move, The Overheating Earth and the Uprooting of America. Specifically climate... we call it climate-driven migration. You know, here in America, we think about climate-driven migration as something that perhaps is occurring in other parts of the world. Like Bangladesh comes to mind, or the Philippines, or low-lying coastal areas that are going to be, or if not already, being impacted by rising sea levels and changes to the soil chemistry and water tables and of course the biology and ecosystems. But your book says that, look, climate-driven migration is a real possibility here in America, all 50 states, let's say.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, climate migration will happen the world over in mm-hmm. Bangladesh and elsewhere. But the message of my book and the findings of my research is that, you know, Americans will not be able to escape both the change and the difficult decision about where they want to live amidst that change. There's a climate niche for human habitability on the planet. And for the United States, that niche is moving northward. And what that basically means is that the southern part of the country will become increasingly, you know, inhospitable. It'll become hot. The hurricane risk will increase. Sea level rise will become a greater threat while we have, you know, increasing difficulty growing crops across the Midwest and in farming regions and wildfires closing in as well. And all of that is going to force Americans, which, you know, the United States has the largest population in its history at around 330 million people, to reconsider where they live throughout this change as well.
So in the U.S., I feel like we seem to inhabit the higher risk areas because of what they offer. So how are people going to come to terms with making these decisions to either stay in the threatened areas or to move? And are you already seeing this?
Yeah, I mean, we all love our sunshine and our nice beach views that have drawn so many people to the Southwest and you know, the Gulf Coast and Florida among them. You know, part of what the book explores is the way that U.S. policy has kind of artificially steered people, financially steered people into those high-risk places. And we've done that by subsidizing the cost of insurance, by subsidizing the cost of water, by subsidizing, you know, the difficulty of by subsidizing the cost of growing extremely water-intensive crops like cotton in places like Arizona. And part of what's shifting now is that those subsidies are going away. And a thesis of this reporting is that, you know, people are likely, Americans are likely to migrate, not just when their physical environment becomes, you know, uncomfortable, which it may do in many places, but when their economic circumstances begin to shift, that ultimately climate migration will be an economic response. And that response is going to begin with the increased cost of living that we're starting to see now in some of the most high-risk parts of the country.
Right. And let's go back and kind of parse out what how a warming world is going to express itself. We like to hear on the show talk about the physical expressions, the chemical expressions, and then again, the biological expressions of a warming world. And you kind of alluded to some of it. Obviously, the most obvious one, the easy one to visualize is rising sea levels and its impacts on the coast, so that physical change, but also rising water tables and perhaps at the coast too, saltwater intrusion into, say, groundwater wells, which has a chemical impact on our water, drinking water, potable water systems, et cetera, and stormwater collection and management systems. And so it's the quick one is to see the coastal impacts of a warming world. But like you alluded to, there's also impacts associated inland too, like with respect to droughts and wildfires. Talk a little bit more about where migration could occur, say, from an inland perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. So I broke down my analysis of risks in the United States to a couple of major threats. So wildfire among them encroaches on the country really from the coasts, from California and Oregon and Washington in the west, and also across the southeast in places like Georgia and Alabama and South Carolina and Tennessee. Examined the fertility of growing regions across the mid part of the United States and used in an economic analysis by the Rhodium Group that projected crop yields in the future across the Great Plains, across Texas, the Oklahoma Panhandle and places like that, and forecast that with warming and with drought, we'll see a steady decline in crop yields that in some places will be total, as much as 90% to 100% decline in crop yields in parts of South Texas, for example. And then we have the declining availability of water, and the Mountain West especially, you know, is in the midst of, you know, a 1,000-year, 1,200-year epochal drought. The Colorado River in particular has, you know, a famously diminished flow, in part because it's so overused, but also because of the impacts of climate change already to this date, you know, are estimated to have reduced the flow of that river substantially and will cause it to reduce, you know, another 10% over the next couple of decades. So those are the pressures that, you know, inland communities will face is higher heat and less availability of water and a decreasing ability to, you know, to use those lands in a productive way to grow food, to grow, you know, grazing grasses for cattle in the way that, you know, that is done so much today.
So migration can take a look that maybe farmers have to change what they grow, or what crops they produce, and like you say, where. Maybe growing cotton in Arizona is not such will not such be such a great idea just from an economic point of view.
Yeah, I mean, that's starting to happen now. Yeah. And, you know, you mentioned the cotton farming in Arizona, and that's really, you know, the one of the first hot spots. There isn't enough water for Arizona to continue to grow its cities like Phoenix the way it has been and continue to produce crops like alfalfa and cotton, both of which are extremely water intensive. So the research suggested that, you know, change in those agricultural practices is inevitable, that places like Arizona will almost certainly have to stop and are stopping growing those crops right now. But I also look at places like California's Imperial Valley, which is an incredibly important, from an agricultural standpoint, an incredibly important, you know, sort of food basket for the country. We grow so much of our winter, you know, vegetables that are distributed to grocery stores across the country there. And that's grown with Colorado River water, and it's grown in the desert. And it's a really, you know, intractable problem to consider what the future means for a place like that. The first step will be, you know, to stop growing crops like alfalfa, which are generally used, you know, for feed for cattle, for the dairy industry and exported overseas. But long term, you know, the researchers that I talked to suggest that the United States will have to consider moving that industry entirely, probably to more fertile and to more productive parts of the country in the future. And when they look at what those regions are that are becoming more productive, you can see the potential for increased farm yields in places like northern Idaho or, you know, a lot closer to the Great Lakes and Minnesota and Wisconsin and Michigan and places like that. So there, you know, there is a potential and there's opportunity, you know, to grow that food. It's not that we expect we'll grow, you know, we'll run out of food here in the United States.
Right.
But there's going to have to be a real geographic change and a habitual change to a lot of our past practices.
Right.
So you've cited the Midwest, which is where I hail from. I hail from Michigan, as maybe an area that people will be migrating to. So in looking at the sustainability of these places that are going to take on this increase in inhabitants, are most of them going to see this as a positive or is this going to be overwhelming? How do you see that shift occurring for the places that people will go?
You know, that's exactly the choice that I think that a lot of places in the United States have. And, you know, the answer to your question, whether this is a positive or a negative, you know, impact is going to depend on how those receiving communities are able to prepare, you know, for the growth or for the change in their populations and, you know, and how optimistic they are about sort of seizing on you know, the new industries, the new energy, the new labor force that those, you know, increased populations can provide. I mean, we've seen a pattern around the world, unfortunately, and in the United States, of friction between, you know, between new communities and old communities in places where migrants are coming in. I mean, you see that even in California, in places like Chico, California, after you know, a terrible wildfire in Paradise, California, a couple of years back, where the migrating population was welcomed at first, and then quickly kind of wore out that welcome. The town of Chico felt overcrowded. It saw its crime rates increase. It saw its parking diminish, and its infrastructure was overwhelmed. And so, in a place like Michigan, you know, success is going to depend on the ability to anticipate those, you know, those sort of structural, infrastructural and policy needs, but also just on, you know, the community's outlook and resilience to that growth.
And also looking at maybe then the demographics, at first I would assume that this is going to be more of a choice to move and you will have the access and the means to do that and making that shift. I've heard you call mobility a factor of ability. Can you kind of break that down for us?
Yeah, I mean, that's right. It's not cheap to move and it takes a lot of energy to move. And so, you know, what we see in migration patterns around the world and what demographers predict, you know, in the United States as well, is that you'll have a band of the population that's really kind of, you know, young to middle-aged with families and middle class that is the most likely to pick up and move. And that's because they're ambitious and energetic and likely will seek, you know, new opportunities or new jobs in places that they move to. And also that they, you know, that they have the wealth that would afford them, you know, the opportunity to flee whatever situation they feel like they need to flee from. You know, at the low end of the spectrum, impoverished people will have the least opportunity to move because it's expensive to move. Mm-hmm. They might not have the assets or, you know, the ability to pick up and go to another place. And then the other end of the spectrum, you know, the ultra wealthy also will probably be a little more reticent to leave because they can afford to fireproof their estates, you know, or build protections against, you know, sea level rise if they're on the coast and things like that, while maybe also having kind of a, you know, a second home or a piece of land as a backup in northern Vermont or a place like that. I talk to a lot of, you know, wealthy folks who use their money to protect themselves in that way, and kind of, you know, draw out their process. You know, but it's the people right in the middle, you know, who can move, you know, who are most likely to do so first.
Let me reintroduce you. We're speaking with Abram Lustgarten. He's the author of the new book, On the Move, The Overheating Earth and the Uprooting of America. I want to talk a little bit more about that, you know, migration versus resiliency. Like you say, there are those who will get it and they will move, and they can afford to move. Those who want to move but can't afford, but like they say, there are those who will say, I'm not moving. I like the Florida Keys. I like, you know, Monroe County. And I'm just going to put my house on stilts. And when we can raise the roads and add more stormwater management pumping systems and stuff, I'm not leaving. How let me put it this way. How do governments go about addressing resiliency like that, or obstinacy, I guess you can call it too, from the public that says, I'm not moving because I don't believe this is a problem?
Yeah, well, you know, first let me just be clear that this is not, you know, a book that predicts a total evacuation,
right,
you know, of hard hit climate areas or an evacuation of the South. I mean, we're talking about a slow moving change and, you know, a shift that will work on the averages, but not the absolute. So we will not likely see, you know, an abandoned Florida or an abandoned Arizona by any means. What we are likely to see in those places is, you know, an urbanization, the you know, concentration of people who remain in larger, you know, mid-sized cities and the large cities, as they find that, you know, they're less resilient in their rural communities if that's where they live. And there's always going to be room for, you know, for people who choose to remain. And there's also always going to be, you know, sort of the flip side of the migration trend is people who are trapped. And, you know, that's the, you know, the less financially nimble side of the spectrum of those people who wish to move but can't afford to move or get trapped by some other economic circumstance. And I think that it's going to be an enormous challenge for communities, for governments and municipalities in these parts of the country to, you know, to, as you say, you know, to manage that degrowth, if that's what it is, or to manage a sort of, you know, a more stagnant or a shrinking size of their community. And, you know, that's going to require keeping, you know, local services proportional to a local tax base. And as some people leave, but some people remain, you know, the risk is that some of these communities will face a declining tax base that suddenly can't afford to do things like repave roads or keep the schools high quality or things like that. And that can, you know, potentially be kind of a negative spiral of decline, which, you know, might allow holdouts to remain where they are now, but eventually, you know, sort of cave in 10 years later when the economy of their community isn't the vibrant, you know, magical place that they recall that it used to be in the past. And, you know, for a community truly to become resilient, it's going to need to invest in very, very expensive infrastructure. And the experts I talked to suggest that, you know, only the larger cities will be able to afford that, to do things like, you know, invest, you know, $500 million in a seawall as, as Charlotte is considering doing, or $120 billion as the New York City metro area may have to do. But smaller communities, rural communities, along the coast that are also exposed to, you know, substantial sea level risk, they'll never have the funds to make that kind of massive infrastructure investment. And so there's going to be, a division, a widening gap between, those more urban areas that have those resources and other areas that just don't have the resources to fight this change.
So when we're looking at this, it looks like we talked about that people are already starting to think about this. Some people have already made some changes or movements or migration. What do you see as the timeline for maybe more of a mass migration?
It's really difficult to predict, the precise movement and the precise timing of movement, only to say that all of the data and the science and the research that is traditionally connected with movement suggests that we will see it. And it suggests the scale, and that scale is very imprecise. As I measure it, it's anywhere between 13 million people, which is the approximate number of people who are directly affected by rising seas, and 160 million people, which is half the U.S. population, which is an estimate of the number of Americans that will experience, a marked degradation in their environment generally, and may or may not choose to move, as a response to that.
Yeah.
So when people start to go, I mean, it kind of depends on, what happens in their specific communities. Some of the most obvious transition points that are already, seeing a large out-migration are along the Gulf Coast. I spent some time, along the coast of Louisiana in communities that have been not only seeing their land subside, but the sea levels rise and forcing communities out. And there were holdouts, in those communities. You see homes that are built up on stilts, some of them 20 feet in the air, as an effort to kind of let the water flow in underneath their homes. But in many cases, even those homes in some of the communities that I visited, a place like Ile de Jean Charles in southern Louisiana, have already, been relocated or have already completely emptied out.
In the scientists that we talked to, it seems like there is an acceleration to climate even faster than we've been predicting.
Oh, the changes.
And
yeah.
The changes, we predict that's when I ask about timelines. We are predicting these out, but it feels like it's coming a little bit faster than even predicted.
Although, Abram, let it be note that today is arguably the snowiest day of the year here in Park City, which also presents its own set of challenges to those who are still a bit skeptical about all this.
I'm glad you get another powder day in the season before the heat waves come. I would take one here too. I tried to focus a lot of the data that my reporting is based off of in the near term, because I think that, we often get lost in projections of climate change that come late in the century or at the end of the century, and it's hard to know what that means. And so, a lot of the changes that I measure in my book and the figures attached to things like a 40% decline in crop yields, in parts of growing regions in the U.S. are for 2040. So we're really talking about, 16 years from now, which is, before a child born today graduates high school, and, well within the range of most people's 30-year mortgages. And that's, a time frame when you start to see, according to the models that I used, really substantial changes in everything from sea level rise to rising temperatures, to declining crop yields, to the increase in extreme fire weather days that make, large wildfires more likely. And you're right, we've seen almost every change around climate change that has been predicted come faster and be more extreme than was anticipated. And we don't know for sure if that's what will continue to unfold in the future, but it seems likely. Mm-hmm. And the models that I just described, that I used are, are in some senses conservative. So that can give you a rough sense of time. I'd expect a large scale migration to be in full swing within, a decade.
Right. A decade or so, you said. That's not on purpose, but that is maybe our cue. We have to wrap up. Yeah. The name of the book is On the Move, The Overheating Earth and the Uprooting of America. The author is Abram Lustgarten. Abram, where can people go to learn more about this book and your other writings? You have other books.
Yeah, you can go to my website. It's www.abraham.com, A-B-R-A-H-M.com, or just Google On the Move, or find it on Amazon.
Abram, thank you so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth, and I think we will stay in touch as we move forward.
Absolutely.
With this issue.
I would love that.
All right.
Thanks for your interest today. I appreciate it.
Okay. Thanks for joining us.
Let's take a break for a couple of underwriters, and we come back, we'll speak with Alexa Friedman. She's an environmental epidemiologist, and she's going to be talking about pesticides, fruits, and vegetables, which ones are on the dirty dozen via the Environmental Working Group. It's This Green Earth. We'll be right back. Welcome back to This Green Earth, the weekly talk show about our relationships with and impacts upon the environment. I'm Chris Cherniak.
And I'm Claire Wiley.
And joining us for the second part of the show is Alexa Friedman. She is an environmental epidemiologist, and she's here to talk about a recent report put out by the Environmental Working Group. Actually, I believe it's an annual report or guide they put out, which identifies fruits and vegetables that have different varieties and types and concentrations of pesticides on them, in them, et cetera. Some that are not so surprising, others are. Alexa, thank you for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks for having me.
Let's start here. The Environmental Working Group puts this report or guidebook out every year, I believe, and they identify those that fruits and vegetables that have high concentrations of pesticides. What goes into why a certain type of fruit or vegetable may have more pesticides in it, varieties of it, types and concentrations of it, and others that do not?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we at Environmental Working Group annually analyze the data that's publicly available from two different regulatory agencies in the US, the USDA and the FDA, which annually sample a number of different produce for pesticide residues. And we found this year, when we took a closer look at the number of pesticides and which pesticides were most commonly found, is that we saw that 4 out of 5 of the most commonly detected pesticides were fungicides. And fungicides are applied often to prevent either mold or mildew growing. So they're often sprayed later in the process than some other pesticides in the growing process of these produce. So one reason that we might see these in higher concentration is because they're applied later in the process. But generally, different pesticides and might be higher on certain produce, either based on the way that they're grown or agricultural practices. But it's not something the report specifically looks at. So we're mostly speculating to why which pesticides would be in higher concentrations than others.
That's a good point, because let's talk a little bit about the definition of pesticides, because pesticides, there's an umbrella of chemicals associated with pesticides. You mentioned fungicides, but I believe, you know, there's insecticides that are part of the pesticide family and weed killers, herbicides. There's other chemicals. So there's a number of different types of chemicals that are applied to the plants or to the soil. So let's say to the tree and maybe sometimes directly to the fruit or the vegetable, correct?
Yes, correct. So there's insecticides, fungicides, herbicides, all of that you mentioned, and they might be applied for different reasons based on the way the produce grows. You know, for example, strawberries grow close to the ground and might be more susceptible to pests. So might have, for example, higher insecticides than other produce that grow further away from the ground.
Oh, okay. So let's dig into, so to speak, the list itself. Which ones are fruits and vegetables were determined to have the most amounts of pesticide, or like you said,
as you call the dirty dozen.
The dirty dozen, yeah.
Right. So some of the produce that are found on the dirty dozen includes strawberries, blueberries, spinach, grape, peaches, pears. And the full list is available on our website, EWG.org. And these are the produce that were sampled again by the USDA and FDA that had the highest amount of pesticide residues, the most amount of different types of pesticides found, and in the highest concentrations. So the way we recommend using our shopper's guide is if someone is concerned about pesticide exposure and want to reduce pesticide exposure, that choosing organic versions of the produce that are found on the Dirty Dozen would be one way to do that, or to prioritize shopping on our other list, the Clean 15, which are those produce that have the least amount of pesticides. And what we saw in this year's analysis is that over 65% of the produce on the Clean 15 had no pesticide residues. So that suggests that if you want to prioritize which produce to buy organic versus conventional or non-organic, that you can buy organic or conventional items on the Clean 15 and then choose organic for the produce that's on the Dirty Dozen.
Okay. So it was interesting that in the Clean 15, there were some fruits or vegetables that also kind of grow close to the ground in a similar fashion that those that were on the Dirty Dozen, but weren't as quote unquote dirty, I'll say, like asparagus and mushrooms. I thought mushrooms would be, you know, again, it's kind of intuitive. You would think like, oh, mushrooms, they're probably pretty quote unquote dirty, but not so much.
Yeah, and that might be due to a couple of different reasons. Again, it's possible that it's the way specifically the produce grows, maybe what season they grow in, and possibly also because we saw such a number of fungicides, maybe their susceptibility to grow mold and mildew on their way to the supermarket after being farmed and grown and harvested.
So as a consumer, obviously it's a bit alarming. A lot of my favorites are on the Dirty Dozen. And what can be done or what is being done to help take away some of these pesticides or help protect us?
Yeah, so each of these pesticides, some have like tolerance limits. So there's an amount in which the EPA says that there's being safe to use. And Environmental Working Group believes that safe doesn't, or legal doesn't always mean safe. So even though some of these pesticides, or most of them, are actually found at levels that are lower than some of these tolerance limits might not be safe for everyone, particularly for susceptible populations like pregnant people or children. So we make this guide every year as a way to help consumers have a resource in which to reduce their pesticide exposure on their own. So the Dirty Dozen serves as one way to identify produce that you might choose to buy organic. And there's also plenty of frozen options for some of these items on the Dirty Dozen as well, because we know that organic isn't an option for everyone, which is also why we have the Clean 15, to identify those produce that if you buy conventional, you can feel more confident that they have less pesticide residue than some of the others.
Is there value in rinsing and washing and scrubbing some of these non-organic fruits and vegetables, or is that not particularly useful?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we still recommend washing your fruits and vegetables to get rid of other things and potentially some pesticides, but it's actually not enough to reduce your pesticide exposure, because the USDA and FDA, they actually wash and peel the fruits before they test for pesticide residues. So all of the findings that are in these publicly available data that Environmental Working Group uses are on fruits and vegetables that are prepared as they should be eaten. So for example, bananas are peeled and those blueberries are washed before that they are tested. So we still believe that you should wash your fruits and vegetables and follow the CDC and other guidelines for how to do that. But it's not enough to completely reduce your pesticide exposure.
Well, when you walk through the grocery store, you see those bags, and they, even organic, will say triple washed. And I've always thought, what does that mean, triple washed? Do they go through a process three different times? And what are they? Yeah.
What does that mean?
What is the purpose?
Right.
If it's organic.
Yeah, it's a good
one. Yeah.
We still recommend washing your fruits and vegetables, running under water, and so you could reduce not only pesticide exposure that way, but the risk of contracting foodborne illnesses.
Now, obviously, rind-based fruits maybe vegetables that have I can't think of one that comes to mind that has a coating or a flesh that you don't eat is going to lend itself to being a little more have fewer pesticides or potential to consume pesticides than those that don't have it, Ryan, like you said, like strawberries or blueberries where you're eating the fruit whole, correct?
It's possible, but again, these produce are tested as they would be eaten. So, you know, like bananas are peeled, the avocados are peeled, and they're testing after that fact as they would be eaten by like a regular person.
Wow. So, yeah, so it's potential that these pesticides show up in the banana's meat, let's say. It's not just on the rind, per se, the flesh.
Yeah, and we do see more rind or, you know, watermelons, kiwis, avocados, pineapples on those Clean 15. And that might be part of, it might be more to do with they need less pesticides during the growing season for other reasons to protect that fruit. But it doesn't necessarily mean that they have no pesticides because, again, the way that they're tested are as eaten.
Okay. We're speaking with Alexa Friedman. She's an environmental epidemiologist with the Environmental Working Group. And we're talking about the EWG's recent report discussing the presence of pesticides on various types of fruits and vegetables, which according to the testing by the, again, like you say, Alexa, this is testing done by the USDA and the Food and Drug Administration. They have a little different type of testing methods, but this isn't testing or work that was done by the Environmental Working Group. This is done by the government to identify what pesticides are showing up on these fruits and vegetables. That's correct, right?
Correct, right. Environmental Working Group downloads this publicly available data every year and analyzes it for the presence of pesticide residues, looks at how many pesticides are found on each type of produce and various other data points to help put together this guide.
Are there trends in one direction or another that EWG is seeing with respect to some of these fruits and vegetables over the years, or some of those in industry, the agriculture, any changing practices or getting better or maybe not so better?
Yeah, it's a great question. There are some things that get better, and then there are some things that, of course, some pesticides we see in higher concentrations than the past, and the reverse is true too. Some other pesticides that were found in higher levels years ago or lower now, and it might reflect the changing landscapes of which pesticides are allowed or what is, you know, changing in the climate and what the needs are for those produce. But we generally see pretty consistently which fruits and vegetables are on the dirty dozen. They tend to stay up there as well as the clean 15. And that might reflect, again, the way that the pesticides are needed for those specific produce.
And again, you know, as we alluded to, pesticides mean fungicides, insecticides, herbicides, maybe even rodenticides to control them in storage facilities. So there's a number of different types of chemicals that can be applied to these fruits and vegetables during their growing season. And like you say, though, fungicides are typically applied near the end process. And not that fungicides are bad, because believe me, we don't want to be consuming fruits with fungus and vegetables with fungus on them, because that has a whole set of complications and potential impacts too. So these chemicals play a role, have benefits. It's that there's the overuse at times of these chemicals, which Rachel Carson in Silent Spring pointed out, you know, 60 years ago. And there's also the synergistic effects of having all of these different chemicals on blueberries and strawberries and apples and pears and peaches, et cetera, that we don't even have a good grasp on.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And, you know, many of these pesticides and fungicides aren't well studied in relation to human health, and particularly, again, for children or pregnant people or babies. So that's another recommendation or ask we have, is that more health studies are conducted to make sure that these pesticides that are used are safe for everyone.
Okay, so again, last couple minutes or so, it would seem that if given the choice, and there's a premium, like you suggest, of eating organic food and fruits and vegetables versus non-organic, that's one way of kind of addressing this situation. The other one is to, again, no matter whether it's organic or inorganic, wash as best can, you know, your fruits and vegetables prior to consumption. Is there anything else that we can do? Maybe that on the pack, read something on the package or look for something on the package.
Yeah, and you know, one thing I haven't gotten the chance to say yet is that people should consume as many fruits and vegetables as possible. They're very healthy for us. They should be always be in our diet, and whether that's organic or conventional. Mm-hmm. For those that have the option or want to reduce their pesticide exposure, we recommend shopping organic on the Dirty Dozen. In terms of packaging, many of these produce found in supermarkets are not labeled with, you know, which pesticides or insecticides, all those things that were used during the process. So partially why we make this guide is for that reason, to give some consumers something to base decision-making off of. So we recommend using this guide, but at the end of the day, eat as much fruits and vegetables and produce as possible, whether they're organic or conventional, because those are an important part of our diet.
And Alexa, where can people go to find this list?
Yeah, you can find the shopper's guide at ewg.org. And if there are any questions or anything like that, you can also always reach out to us via social media or otherwise.
Thank you so much.
All right. Alexa Friedman, environmental epidemiologist with the Environmental Working Group. As always, thank you so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right. Let's take another quick break, and we come back. One more guest, Dita Seed, Center for Biological Diversity, talking about a presentation coming up this Thursday.
Well, they're trying to protect a threatened migratory bird, and we're going to talk about conference that they're going to have to make sure that people hear what's happening with the Endangered Species Act.
We'll get to that in a minute. We'll be right back. It's This Green Earth.
It's so much fun.
You see your friends and neighbors and teachers.
Everyone's running or walking or cheering.
I've never done a race like it.
Going through all the schools, seeing each school's spirit.
Anyone can do it.
The party at the end is so much fun.
Food, games, music, prizes, and drinks.
Everyone is there.
It's the best day of the year.
It's the best fundraiser for our students, teachers, and schools.
Running with Ed is May 18th. Early bird registration is open now at runningwithed.com. Don't miss it.
Running with Ed is a project of PCEF and a KPCW supporter.
Matt here from San Francisco Design. Since the start of our business in 1990, we have been supporting KPCW. We offer home decor for Park City and Salt Lake and feature modern furnishings from around the world. Whether you're looking to furnish an entire home or just redecorating a single room, we can help with our in-house design team. Located on Bonanza Drive and on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
And we're back. This is This Green Earth. I'm Claire Wiley.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
And now we are going to be speaking with Dita Seed, who is with the Center for Biological Diversity. And Dita is going to be talking about an effort to protect a threatened migratory bird. It is the Wilson phalarope. And thank you so much for joining us, Dita.
Thank you for inviting me.
So I understand that you do have a conference coming up, press conference, or a rally, that is, as well, to announce the filing of an Endangered Species Act listing petition for the Wilson's phalarope. Can you tell us about what you're going to be doing on Thursday and then why this is so important?
Sure. So on Thursday at 11 a.m., from 11 to noon, on the south steps of the Utah Capitol, we're having a press conference and rally to show support for protection of this amazing little bird, which is sort of emblematic of the fate of Great Salt Lake. If we can't, if we save the bird, we're saving ourselves, essentially. So we have an amazing lineup of speakers. We're gonna have author and naturalist Terry Tempest Williams. We're going to have BYU professor and ecologist Ben Abbott. We have representatives from UYES, a youth organization. We're also going to hear from the lead scientist, one of the most expert people on Wilson's phalarope in the world. And you know, this listing petition is the filing this listing petition on Thursday is the beginning of a process to save the species. And as I said earlier, by saving the species, we're also saving Great Salt Lake and saving ourselves.
What is the, why is this species endangered? What's going on with it?
Well, so Wilson's phalarope, which is, you know, a migratory bird species, relies very heavily on saline lakes through its migratory journey. And Great Salt Lake in particular is very important. There are about a million Wilson's phalarope in the world, and 60% of them use Great Salt Lake on their journey to South America in the winter. So they come to Great Salt Lake and they go through a full molt. They lose all of their feathers and then have to restore their feathers and gain enough body weight to make a 4,000-mile journey to Argentina, a nonstop flight.
Wow.
And if you see pictures of these birds, it's just amazing to imagine what they're doing. Now, these birds have evolved to feed on brine flies and brine shrimp. They're very specifically linked to saline lakes. And with climate change and water diversion, saline lakes are disappearing across the world. And many of the lakes that and places that these birds have relied on previously no longer exist. They've dried up or they've been paved over. So Great Salt Lake is the last best place for these birds. And, you know, saving them will require saving the lake.
So if they are placed on the Endangered Species Act protection, what does that mean for them?
Well, yeah. So what comes with that is that a recovery plan for the species and protection of the species' critical habitat. And so, you know, in a nutshell, that means protecting Great Salt Lake in a healthy way, not preventing ecosystem collapse, so that the birds can continue to come here and feed and be healthy and continue on their journey to Argentina.
So as a result, the entire ecosystem, so you're not just saving this species, you are also having a ripple effect on others.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And the other the other thing is, it's not just Wilson's phalarope that's at risk. There are many migratory bird species whose populations would be devastated if Great Salt Lake collapses ecologically. We're all connected. And the fate of these birds is connected to our fate.
So, again, who are we trying to win over here? Who are we trying to convince that needs convincing that this bird needs protection?
Well, so an Endangered Species Act listing petition is a science-based document that is submitted to the United States Fish and Wildlife Service. And the scientists there will evaluate what we're putting forth, which is the best science on the threatened status of the Wilson's phalarope. So what we hope will happen is that they will say, yes, this species is indeed threatened, and they will take the regulatory measures to compel protection for this bird species. And that might mean telling the state of Utah that more water needs to go into Great Salt Lake. In fact, that could be a likely outcome. But, you know, also things like you can't pave over every inch of the shoreline of Great Salt Lake, which unfortunately is, you know, something that's in the works right now. There's the state is sponsoring pretty intensive industrial development through the Utah Inland Port Authority that will compromise wetland and shoreline habitat of Great Salt Lake. So this is a way to confer protection that's very powerful protection.
Right. So protecting the lake protects brine shrimp populations and its food source, whereby protects the bird, as you alluded to. There is a ripple effect associated with it. There's a chain of events that go on. But by trying to protect the bird, we protect so many, we protect the entire ecosystem.
Absolutely. And have you gone through this process before and been successful with these petitions?
Well, so a local example is the June sucker, which is a fish that only exists at Utah Lake. And that species was almost extinct when it was listed as endangered. And a few years ago, because of the effort to restore June sucker habitat, which actually had the ripple effect of restoring the Provo Bay Delta and other areas of Utah Lake that are critical to the fish, the fish was downlisted to threatened. So it went from endangered to threatened. That's a success story. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the Endangered Species Act has been successful in protecting 99% of the species that are listed. It is probably one of our most important environmental protection tools.
So to learn more about not only this and how people can get involved, but about things that you do at the Biological Diversity Center, can you give us a website and tell us where to lead people?
So centerforbiologicaldiversity.org is our website. And we are in the process of putting on our website information, lots of information about the species and the listing petition. It should be all finalized by tomorrow.
Fantastic. And again, tomorrow is Thursday is the presentation.
Yeah. And everyone's invited, and it should be inspiring. You know, for people that are concerned about the fate of Great Salt Lake, this is a powerful action that we're taking. We have some amazing inspirational speakers, and, you know, show your support for saving the lake and saving Wilson's phalarope and ensuring a healthy and sustainable future for Utah, but also for, you know, migratory birds across the Pacific Flyway.
Right. Dita Seed with the Center for Biological Diversity. As always, thank you so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
Sure.
Thank you.
Thank you for inviting me.
Sir, premiering tonight at 9, 8 Central.